Hello, folks. Audio sounds good from over here. I presume you can hear me. My name is John Thorne, and I'm guessing that most of you in the audience know me because I come to these things every year. And I'm going to introduce briefly my three panelists, but invite each of them to add on to my skeletal introduction. I'd like to point out that the Imagining Baseball title, which refers to the game of baseball as played between the ears, is not imaginary in an exhibit case at the National Museum of American Jewish History, which is just a few blocks down the way on Market. And it is the sponsoring body for this exhibition, and we're going to be putting together an exhibition for 2014 called Chasing Dreams, the Jews in Baseball, that I think will be of extraordinary interest to all of us. In light of our sponsorship, we gathered four Jews here, and we are not... It's not going to be old Jews telling jokes. You got to go to YouTube for that. I'll introduce all three briefly and then give time to each. Mark Cooper, to my immediate right, is the one who has amassed the most incredible, without parallel, collection of baseball board games, dice games, mechanical games. So I have some interesting questions later on to reflect upon his possible sanity. In the middle is Eric Rolf Greenberg, who 30 years ago, in 1983, and you'll correct me if I'm wrong, Eric, published The Celebrant, which Sports Illustrated ranked in its survey about a dozen years ago as the third best baseball novel ever. I will say that I rated higher than that. Last is Steve Wolfe, an old friend, background ESPN, Sports Illustrated, and he has been watching and thinking about baseball forever, and one of the things that we're going to ping him about today is his original membership in the Rotisserie League with Danny Okrent and some others, some of them in this audience, I believe. Last of the prefatory remarks is that this is the 125th anniversary of the Great Ballad of the Republic, Casey at the Bat, which was published in the San Francisco Examiner on June 3rd, 1886. I'm doing my Rain Man thing here. And then on August 14th of that year, DeWolf Hopper interrupted Prince Methusalem between acts in order to recite this because the members of the New York Giants and Chicago White Stockings were in the audience. And Hopper, in his autobiography, mentioned that at the stunning conclusion of the poem, Captain Ewing's mustachios twitched. Eric, I'm going to start with you with the generic question I'm going to ask of each of you. What would you like us to know about you besides the fact that you have written an all-time great baseball novel?
The less the better. I'm content to be known for that. I invariably disappoint people who come to meet me as author of The Celebrant. They're expecting some kind of Jewish baseball Dostoevsky. And I'm far from that.
Dostoevsky wasn't Jewish?
I'm convinced that I saw Hannes Wagner play shortstop. And I mean that quite literally. I don't mean as a flight of fancy for a fiction writer. It was at an old-timers game at Yankee Stadium in the early 50s. They were the only team that had old-timers games back then, and they invited famous Yankee opponents as well as Yankees. I've convinced myself that I saw Wagner. I know for sure that I saw Frank Home Run Baker, hero of the 1912 World Series, playing third base and at bat. And I know for sure that I saw people introduced in mufti, not in uniform. So these eyes have seen Ty Cobb. Connie Mack, and terribly old, and walking with assistants, Denton True Young, Cy Young, 512 major league victors, who lost a 1-0 game in his last season against a rookie pitcher and decided he was going to hang him up because when the rookies are beating you, it's time to go. And the rookie was Grover Cleveland Alexander. So I know I saw these, but I am convinced that I saw Hannes Wagner play shortstop in uniform at one of those games. Now, this being the Society for American Baseball Research, I'm sure one of you is going to run up and run out and check the Yankee archives and see whether or not this is in fact the case, that Hannes Wagner was invited to one of these early old-timers games at the stadium. If you find something out in that regard, please don't tell me.
When dreams
die
hard.
Because I prefer not to know, and because it makes a better story this way. And, of course, that's what imagination does. It makes better stories, or more extended stories, perhaps truer stories. And we use imagination constantly, even while we're watching a game. Especially if we're not watching it at the ballpark. We have to use our imaginations to create the spatial relations that are so important in baseball if we watch it on a two-dimensional flat-screen television. And, of course, we have to fill in all the action in our own minds if we're listening on radio, and all the more so if we're simply reading or listening to reportage of it. And that is true of the game as played. Never mind how it's made up in fiction. I find remarkable the fact that when Joe DiMaggio's streak ended around this time of year in Cleveland in 1941, two great plays by Ken Keltner at third base prevented the streak from continuing. And yet, remarkably, there is not a single picture of those Keltner plays. Imagine what would happen today. They'd be embossed on cheap china and sold that night on late night television. But no, so we only have Keltner's plays in imagination. And to take imagination further in this regard, James Thurber said that every American male goes to bed striking out Joe DiMaggio with the bases loaded in the World Series. So we inject ourselves imaginatively into this game. Baseball can't exist without that kind of imagination, which results in the kind of fandom and passion that's represented in this room and by the people on this panel, and especially by John. So we need imagination to fully appreciate what goes on. Otherwise, the game is reduced to mere statistics, which have no enduring life and hold upon the imagination. So all hail the imagination and all hail baseball.
In order to provide a Johnny Carson-type segue, I'm going to go to the second question I had for you, Eric, rather than the first. But first, we need to give an opportunity to our other panelists to follow that very hard act. So, Mark, would you wish to tell us anything beyond the fact that you've got a basement or attic full of more games than anybody else has?
Thank you, John. Welcome to Philadelphia, my hometown, and I hope you're enjoying it. Anyway, so I consider myself, other than this OCD person who acquired this collection, sort of an ambassador of the game of baseball. And, you know, I'm preaching to the choir, obviously, but, you know, baseball is life, right? And it's, you know, the harder you work, the better you do, the fact that, you know, you can be down by 5 runs with your last strike and, you know, you can win and vice versa. And so I played baseball, you know, my whole life in college, and I played up to about 50. And then I decided to sort of coach my children's teams. And we'll talk a little later about I have a 30-year career working for the baseball fantasy camps throughout the American and National League. So between the white lines, you know, what I've learned is the excitement of the game, but also the fact that, and I'm not going to try and wax poetic like Ray Kinsella, but you know, it's this timelessness, right? That what drew me to my board games is the fact that no clock in baseball, that board games, there's no clock, and that childhood, which really is what baseball is all about, is sort of the perfect connection and mixture and blend of this cosmic thing that baseball is all about. And so, you know, the age distribution in this room is, you know, baby boomer and above, right? So how do we continue this? No other sport has this transgenerational thing that baseball has. We all remember the first time we saw that green. You know, we used to watch it on the black and white TV, and Billy Crystal talked about it, and everybody did, right? So how do we continue this so that the next generations appreciate this greatest game, our national pastime? And so I took it upon myself to, you know, I would coach all the, my son, his friends, you know, they sort of reminisce. They're like 27 now, and we can be drinking, having a beer, and they'll remember when they were 6 years old and they were the Marlins and they got this hit or struck out. And it's amazing to me they did it, but I made sure that in all these teams I coached, every week we went over a rule, whether it was the infield fly rule or catcher's interference. And then we also did a historical thing where I would teach them something about who Roberto Clemente or Hank Greenberg or Bob Feller is. So I think what I'm trying to say is that, you know, with this game that we all love, I think it's incumbent upon us to sort of pass the baton, and that's what I've tried to do my whole life.
That's beautiful. When you mentioned childhood in this context, I thought childhood has no clock, especially for Sabre members.
That's correct.
Steve, what would you like us to know about you besides ESPN, SI, books, magazines? Go ahead.
I've been covering baseball for a long time. There's one story that has stuck with me. This was years ago. I was working for Sports Illustrated, and I was in the Yankee clubhouse doing a story I don't remember. But as it happened, I was waiting for the player to come in, and Pete Shahey, the ancient clubhouse guy for the Yankees, came in, and he sat down opposite me at the picnic table in the center of the clubhouse. And, you know, we started talking about the weather and about the Yankees and things like that, and it was a very nice conversation. And I finally got up the nerve to say, "Pete, you knew Babe Ruth. What was he really like?" And Pete looked around to make sure there was nobody else in the room, and he quietly said to me, "He never flushed the toilet." Now, this would be the perspective of the clubhouse guy, naturally. But the postscript to this is that a year or so later, my brother-in-law, who's in construction, was renovating a house in Sudbury, Massachusetts. And it was Babe Ruth's old residence in Sudbury. And he called me up and he said, "Do you want the bathtub or the toilet?" Which is why I actually own Babe Ruth's bathtub. That's me. I own Babe Ruth's bathtub.
Well, elevating the tone, Eric. Do you still watch a lot of baseball? Watching it on television, no matter how well-produced the coverage, provides something of a wormhole view and depicts the players as surreal or super real. No one saw a ball game this way in Christy Mathewson's day, as you alluded in your opening remarks. How, absent TV, radio, color photography, did a boy in the first two decades of the century choose a ball player for a hero?
in the celebrant, he chooses Matheson because Matheson is everything that he is not, he being the narrator of the book, everything that he is not. He projects himself onto Matheson. I imagine that's true of most of us when we choose our heroes. My hero growing up was Pee Wee Reese. My brother could reduce me to tears instantly by telling me that Pee Wee had been traded to Cincinnati. When I was quite young, I asked Ruth Reese for an autograph outside of Ebbets Field. And he picked me up in his arms, held me like this, wrote the autograph. Are you here by yourself? No, I'm here with my brother. We identify with these people. They come to us in a variety of ways. Back in Matheson's day, one of the great fun things about researching and writing the Celebrant was finding out all the different ways that you receive baseball. Well, just by going to the park. You'd go into a bar and they'd be chalking the plays on the wall. You'd read wire service transcripts that were posted outside newspaper shops. You'd go to Times Square and see the action of the game on the Times Building, going in electric lights round and round. You went to Madison Square Garden, and you watched the players' cutouts being moved, duplicating the actions that were going on 90 miles away in Philadelphia during the 05 World Series. Baseball was unavoidable, and out of all of this, you chose those characters who had a particular appeal to you, not all of them being great stars. I have a certain affection for George Shotgun Shuba, who was a pinch hitter and reserve outfielder for the Dodgers of the early 50s, who swung 200 times a day all winter long. I didn't make it past 100 after I read that. My arms fell off. So we receive in America baseball through the ground, like Antaeus, being renewed in his energies from the earth. It's unavoidable. The better question, the harder question would be, how do we avoid it, not where do we pick it up?
You know, there are so many questions about heroes. Why do grown-ups need heroes? You know, certainly that is at issue with the looming drug suspensions, but let's not go there. Mark, this is for you. Many of us in this room have played baseball games off the field with dice, cards, spinners, pegs, or on our computers or smartphones. Yet the impulse to recreate the game in the parlor is a very old one, and it is the old board games that grabbed your attention. What made you love them, and were they baseball or were they something else? How important was realism to the generations who played these games?
Well, you know, board games are incredibly representative of the culture from whence they came and when they were produced. You know, the first board game was this 1843 Mansion of Happiness. It was sort of like a Candyland thing about virtues and vice. And so back when there was an agrarian society, you know, there really wasn't much time to have any free time. But with the urbanization of the United States, just as that was the impetus for baseball to evolve, so it was the impetus of the parlor to be the oasis for playing board games. So we all know that after the Civil War, you know, with the propagation of our national pastime throughout the United States, all of a sudden this became a way for the populace to learn about the game of baseball. And, you know, we'll talk a little later, but, you know, 1930 was sort of a seminal year in the simulated baseball games versus the pre-sims. And so back in the 1860s, you know, the first board games were created. It's sort of ironic that one of the first board games created actually was pentagonal, you know, prior to home plate being a pentagon. So it's sort of, you know, where did that come from? Some you know, ephemeral being created that game. But the games from the 19th century, as baseball evolved, and my passion is the history of baseball. You know, my hero is John Thorne, is just to how baseball indeed did evolve so that these board games that were created, whether the first and third basemen were playing in foul territory because of the fair foul rule, or some of your cards would be like catch it on a bound, you're out, these daisy cutters, things where there were no benches or seven balls or a walk, four strikes in 1894 is an out. So the beautiful chromolithographic technique that occurred in that turn of the century, like in the 1860s, 1870s, this ability to sort of use these different stones to create these incredibly beautiful images also taught the populace about baseball, whether it was the, you know, all of a sudden, 1886, there's a player endorsed game that has Clarkson and Brothers on it. You know, there's a game from 1889 by McLaughlin Brothers World Tour, which commemorated the 1889 World Tour. And, you know, so it was a historical perspective, and it gave the populace of the United States, you know, the ability to learn this game. And it was, as you said, it wasn't really, it was more chance and luck. It was really about just dice and spinners and things like that. And it wasn't until the sim games occurred where it became more realistic. But that's it. Board games reflect what's going on. And as far as our national pastime, that's what it did.
Thanks, Mark. Steve, this one's for you. We reconstitute, reshape, remake the game whenever we think about it or write about it. What do you think explains the impulse to play vintage baseball recreations or visit the Hall of Fame? Can we feel nostalgia for a time beyond our personal experience?
I'm a hopeless romantic when it comes to the magic of baseball, which is its timelessness. You know, the game, as you all know, the game has changed radically over the years, and yet it remains the same. You know, I think we all suspect that if Butch Husky was put in a time machine back to 1927, he would have hit 70 home runs. But because baseball is able to, because of the geometry of baseball, because of the rules of baseball, it's been able to evolve and take in all these incredible developments and the improvements in physical conditioning. But, you know, runners run faster, but fielders throw harder. Pitchers throw harder, but batters swing faster. They're all able to catch up with one another. And I think that's what upsets so many people about the steroid era, is that it was such a abrupt departure from the natural flow of the game. And it's that timelessness that keeps drawing us back to Cooperstown, keeps us playing, keeps us involved in nostalgia, reading books about old baseball. There's no other sport like it, at least in America, where you can imagine what it was like to see Honus Wagner play in his prime, because you know what it was like, and you know you don't need film. You don't need a board game. You know what it must have been like to have played baseball at the turn of the century, because you see it at the turn of this century. There's just something about it that, it's no mistake that home plate is in the shape of a house. This is the house that we
want. An upside down house, of course.
Upside down house. Actually, years ago when I was at ESPN, the magazine, we had this something called the 001, which was the back page of the magazine. And one of the things we did was to create a house out of home plate using all sorts of baseball paraphernalia, like the pine tar rag was the smoke coming out of the chimney, and the windows were bubble gum. And, you know, so we made it look like a house. And that's what I think draws us back to baseball. It's home.
What you talked about in terms of the changes of the game certainly apply at the major league level, but sandlot ball is just like it always was. When you first pick up a bat, when you first pick up a ball, you're doing exactly the same experience that your grandfather, your great-grandfather might have done. The game at the neighborhood level, it has changed much less than the game at the major league level, and that's really how we first experienced the game.
You're right.
I think that last line in Field of Dreams, where they say, "Dad, do you want to have a catch?" You know, I cry every time I see it. And I can see it 100 times, and I'll still cry.
So you rated 5 hankies.
Yes, it's a 5 hanky. That was the first time my children, they were sitting on my lap in the movie theater, and I started crying. They never saw their father cry before, and it was because of that, you know. Yeah.
Eric, this one's going to be for you. Why did you feel that you needed a baseball setting beyond your personal memory? Most baseball novelists deal with the current game or the game of their own youths.
I don't think of The Celebrant as a baseball novel. I think of it as a religious novel about gods and heroes and hero worship and the effect on hero and worshiper, about the Judeo-Christian conflict, and about the immigrant experience. Baseball is a setting for all of it. And an important setting, vital setting. But what drew me to write the story was its religious symbolism. When I read 8 Men Out, Eliot Asenoff's excellent, unparalleled biography, reportage of the Black Sox scandal, and I'm looking forward to the next session at 11 o'clock that's going to investigate that. I was struck right between the eyes by the image of Mathewson, back from the war, dying of his illness that he contracted during the war, sitting on high in the press box next to Hugh Fullerton, in judgment of the players with whom he once walked, making marks in a scorecard at any dubious play that might reveal that the game wasn't on the up and up. And that image of Mathewson on high judging the players, and then you look at his name and there it is all the time, Christie, 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 Christ, Christ, Christ. And I said to myself, I think there's a novel there. And it helped that I knew that I was writing to that from the beginning. My high school English teacher, who told me I should be a writer and ruined my life, taught that comedies begin in confusion and end in prosperity. Tragedies begin in prosperity and end in catastrophe. So I knew from the get-go that I was writing a tragedy, and that I was going to begin it in prosperity, and I was going to end it in tragedy. And that was Mathewson's life. I took great liberties with that life, and with his interior life especially. The Mathewson that was probably bore very little resemblance to the Mathewson that I wrote, especially in the latter pages of the novel. But that doesn't matter. You throw away fact because you're after some kind of deeper truth. That's what fiction writing is about. That's what imagination is about.
Mark, for you, I have questions galore. I could go on for hours. These guys could go on for hours without me. But I'm going to cut the questions short after Steve gets his second go-around to permit questions, because I have the feeling that many of you will wish to talk with these gents. Mark, many who live in the world of imagined baseball come to love the stats or the stories or the artifacts more than they do the game itself. To what extent, if at all, would that describe you?
So, as I mentioned before, you know, 1930 was that seminal event where Clifford Van Beek created this national pastime game, which was the first sim game. And from that embryo All-Star Baseball from Ethan Allen in 41, and Dick Seitz' APBA in 50, and 61 with Stratt and Hal Richman. And so, you know, I appreciate so much that sim game, but me personally, I enjoy it, but because I play the game and coach it and sort of do it in three dimensions with the, you know, testosterone rush of being in a game where between the white lines, I mean, you have to be totally focused, I don't have the passion for those sim games. And, you know, I don't want to, I remember I gave a talk at an APBA conference, and in my book, you know, I have just All-Star Baseball in it, and I didn't have APBA, and boy, they tar and feathered me. You know, they said, like, what is this? And I said, I didn't have room. I had to pick that. So as far as that, but, you know, the stories you talk about, I don't know if I should talk about this now or later, but,
There's no later.
Okay,
we're running out of time.
So anyway, as these stories that we talked about the real players, so in 1983, you know, Randy Hundley started this fantasy camp for the Cubs, and then in 84, a friend of mine I played ball with decided to pitch it to the Phillies, and so we created this baseball fantasy camps, and so from that time on, for 30 years, I work for these fantasy camps, you know, and so at these camps where all these baby boomers play, and I sort of, my job is to throw BP and help the pros manage and draft and keep the book and make everybody happy. I got a chance to sit in the locker room with all these icons, and we would just hear stories. And so many of these stories, you know, you've read about, but I have, there's so many stories about what has never been published. Like I did the Phillies in 85, and Richie Ashburn talks about in the 51 All-Star game, before the game, Ted Williams and Stan Musial behind the cage, talking about the art of hitting, and one, two, three, all of a sudden 50 guys were around there. Joe DiMaggio threw in some information, and he said if that had been taped, you know, that would have been the most ultimate book on hitting, that Dick Allen used to say that no pitcher ever threw at him because he had such great bat control that he could just if he came in tight, his 40-ounce back would hit a line drive straight up the middle. I was traded to the Pirates in 86, and I heard these stories about Fregosi talking about what it was like to manage Nolan Ryan, and how Hal Smith's wife stopped talking to Rocky Nelson's wife because Hal Smith would have been we would have been Bill Mazeroski if that 9-8 line drive by Burr was converted into a double play, and so he no longer, or traded to the Indians, and having Ray Boone tell the story about Ted Williams' last at bat, and any story has to have four-letter expletives, but when Higgins asked Ted, after he's brought in from the outfield, to go back out and take a curtain call, Ted, Ray was his roommate, and so Ray went and said, Ted, you got to take a curtain call. And Ted said, F those bean eaters. And that was the true story, not the 80-20.
I have a feeling that the project that Sabre ought to tackle next as a book is The Unwritten History of Baseball. Steve, this is for you. And maybe you dread this question because you've spoken about rotisserie baseball so frequently, and it may not be a part of your present landscape at all. When you reflect upon the original rotisserie baseball game and its players and that mediocre French restaurant where it all began, what leaps to mind? And do you still play the game?
I do still play the game. My team is terrible, but we have a cool name. It's Sheep's Clothing. I remember, although I'm a member of the original Rotisserie League, I was not there the first year. So I'm kind of like one of those late signers of the Declaration of Independence. You're right, Thomas McKean or whatever, you know, guys who signed after the fact. But I do remember the date in which Dan Okrent first told me about the Rotisserie League. It was at the 1980 baseball meetings at the Lowe's Anatole in Dallas. And it was December 7th, 1980. And I remember the date not so much because it was Pearl Harbor Day, but because it was, the next day was when John Lennon was assassinated. It was a rather epic winter meeting. It was where Bruce Sutter was traded for Raleigh Fingers, all sorts of trades. I met Dan Okrent, and he introduced me to the Rotisserie League. At the time, they did not have an opening. He said, we are forming an American League version, the Tony's Italian Kitchen League, so you could join that. And that's how I met FX Flynn, who's here somewhere. And at the same time, somebody did drop out of the original Rotisserie League. And I inherited a terrible team. I only kept one player. It was Jose Cruz. But somehow, I managed to build a decent team that was helped by the fact that it was a strike-shortened season. So my very first year in the Rotisserie League, I actually won. And that was the last time I won. Everyone thought I had some sort of inside edge because I was a baseball writer. But in fact, I just sort of went by instinct. If you can believe it, my bullpen consisted of Woody Fryman and Stan Bonson. That's how long ago this was. But because the Rotisserie League was made up of all these giants in publishing, editors and writers, and tremendous self-promoters, word got out quickly. And within a couple of years, FX Flynn had us put together a book. It was a green paperback, Rotisserie League. I forget what the motto was. The best game. Okay, go ahead. That's right, the greatest game since Terry. And I think the book did okay. Did all right. But I had always, because I was covering baseball, I was a little worried that baseball players would find out about this, because I thought it was somehow demeaning if they would think it demeaning that people owned them and traded them. And I was always a little worried about this, that we were crossing the line, much like in the celebrant, you need to maintain a certain distance.
Exactly.
So shortly after the book came out, I was standing behind the batting cage at Shea Stadium, just watching batting practice, and this huge shadow comes over my head, and I look behind me, and it's Dale Murphy, the center fielder for the Atlanta Braves, whom I had done a story on a couple of years earlier. And he says to me, how's your Rotisserie League team doing? And you know, he would have been the last person you would have thought would have known about the Rotisserie League, being a devout Mormon. But he was fascinated by the concept of the game. He loved it. And I said, well, do you want to play it? Thinking maybe we could bring him into the league. And he said, no, it's actually against my religion to do that. And I said, well, thanks. But over the years, as the game spread, the barriers broke down. And now I'm in a league where the members of the league regularly tweet some of the players that they own. So it's actually broken down over the years. Given the immense popularity of the game, it's kind of understandable, but it's
a
little...
What do the Mormons have against...
You can't gamble.
Yeah.
Okay. I said you could use bottle caps, but he chose not to go that direction.
Go ahead, Steve.
And then in those early years of the Rotisserie League, we would occasionally invite a player to our annual spring training banquet at the Don Cesar. It was never a very famous player. We got Mike Ramsey, the infielder for the Cardinals, to come once, and Dave LaPointe. We worried that we got him too drunk, so we drove him home. So.
All right, folks, I'm going to open questions to all on the panel. It'll be a free-for-all, and while I do this, anyone who has questions for our panelists, please line up at the microphone, and we will get to you very shortly. I've tried to leave enough time for some fun at that end. Now, to the panelists, while we have our questioners line up.
I'm Hal Smith from Atlanta Brave Country, and I imagine a baseball world in which I wake up one morning and we have reverted to the 154-game schedule. The wild card playoff will be three games instead of one.
This is your Benjamin Button thing, right?
The division series will be seven games instead of five. And I want to know from you guys, why in the world can that dream not come true? Why can't this happen? Why can't baseball realize the unfairness of a one-game playoff to the fans, to the players, to the teams, as well as a five-game playoff when you play 162 games and then get eliminated in one game?
Why can't that happen? Does anybody on the panel want to tackle that?
I actually like the idea of the one-game playoff.
Me too.
Because I like that a team is tested under every condition, that they have to win a one-game playoff, okay? And now they have to go and win a best of five and a best of seven. It shows that a team is both resourceful and has a lot of heart to do that. So I actually think it's a fair test.
I also think that the one-game playoff is sensational because it has restored meaning to winning the division.
Amen.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
I guess I'm in the minority then, huh?
So whom are you directing this question, or to any and all?
I think any and all. It seems to me that a lot of the kind of mythology about the imagining of baseball as you're talking about is rooted in maybe up to the 1950s or so in the sort of more traditional urbanism when there was a lot of people out playing baseball from morning to night. And I wonder what impact do you think it has made that is largely no longer the case in America, that kids are out playing all different sorts of baseball all day long during the summer?
I'll take that. So I agree with you that, you know, my book I wrote, I stopped at 1960, 70 with free agency, electronics, and the purity of all these playing the game. And I guess that's sort of one thing I wanted to throw out to everybody here and to the panel, in that what makes, I think, baseball along with your line is that football, basketball, you take players from 50 years ago, 40 years ago, they can never compete with people today. But if you take the all-star players from a century ago, whether it's Mathewson or Johnson or Ruth or Gehrig or Feller or DiMaggio or Mano or Mays or whomever, you know, has there ever been a greater five-tool player than Mays? So what is it about baseball that makes that eye-hand coordination, all the PEDs, all the working out? You give me nine guys from 100 years ago or 50 years ago, and I think they'll beat the guys today. And I don't know what anybody here on the panel thinks, but I get in so many arguments with football or basketball fans that they say, oh, no, baseball's not like that. So,
anyone else want to speak to that question?
I was referring more to kind of the imagining that you're talking about and the, I don't know, I guess kind of the mythology and the way that the game is sort of rooted in American tradition and how that might be different now that there's not such a broad experience of playing baseball.
There's other options, you know, lacrosse, soccer, things like that for the kids.
But there is this notion of the golden age of baseball, that somehow if we could be transported back to, you know, if we could take Ruth to the present day and take Pujols back to the 1920s, we would get very surprising results. All the same, apart from the statistical evidence that baseball is better than ever, we do have this notion that giants walked the earth in the days of yore, and we don't have that about Bronco Nagurski or George Mikan or Maurice Rocket Richard. Yes, sir.
First of all, excuse me, it's APBA is pronounced APBA. Steve, thank you for Rotisserie Baseball.
Is that with a silent A at the end?
I've never found a way of alienating friends, family, and women more quickly than discussing the Snarks, my team. Eric, your book is, in my opinion, and I'm not really a qualified literary critic, next to Call It Sleep, I think it's the best novel of American Jews.
I think you're an excellent judge.
But it's the best novel I've read. I haven't read them all, of Jews navigating assimilation. I'm curious to know as to whether you got different kinds of reviews from baseball sources, religious sources, and regular reviewers.
I'm not sure exactly what you're asking when you talk about sources.
Did reviewers in religious magazines treat it differently and see different things than reviewers in the New York Times?
Different reviewers have picked up different aspects of the book. There's a wonderful book, and I'm struggling for the title, and Alan, where are you? Alan High's book. Is he here? What's the title? Okay. I'm sorry, I couldn't hear it. The Great God Baseball. When you read reviews, especially when you read academic reviews, you're astonished with what they think you've done. And you're baffled by the language with which they describe what they think you've done. But as I say, I thought about The Celebrant initially as a religious novel. I eagerly opened a letter that I got from someone in Baltimore who ended his name on the return address SJ, Society of Jesus. I wanted to see what a Jesuit had to say about my book. I ripped open the letter. Turns out he's a retired priest in Baltimore whose delight is to read historical novels and point out anachronisms. And he took me very much to task for having John McGraw call Hank O'Day a motherfucker, which he said was not popular a curse word until the 50s.
Not so.
So there was, and then many years later, I read Alan's chapter about the celebrant in The Great God Baseball. And I said, well, there's someone who got it. There's someone who got it, who got what I thought I was putting there. So yeah, different reviewers have picked up different things. All of them have been very kind, and I appreciate it. Although I do think that there are people out there who really hate the book but won't say so. I know everything that's wrong with the book. I'm probably the only one who knows everything that's wrong with the book. So when I read the praise, often there's a strain that goes through my head, said, didn't you see this? Didn't you see where I screwed that up? And if I could do it again, I'd rework the last chapter of the book to get better what I was at.
How would you do that?
I'm sorry?
What would the last chapter read like now if you had to do it?
I'm sorry, I don't hear well.
I'm sorry, what would
this echo that this creates?
Excuse me, I don't think we can go here. We have other people with questions.
Okay, I'm sorry.
So next, please.
This is for the entire panel. But just a statement, I think Wilt Chamberlain could still play today. I know we're in Philadelphia, but I just want to throw that in, if he was 25 years old. Now the baseball question. How do you guys see baseball? You know, you look at our members here in Sabre, the median age is 61 or whatever it was we mentioned yesterday. Say 50 years from now, 100 years from now, where will we be with baseball? Where will we, the younger kids today who are preteen, teenagers in their 20s, will they have the same love for the game that our audience out here does, and that's for any of you to address that. I know it's hard to look 50 years in the future, but just your comments on that.
And I do know this, 50 years in the future, there will be this incredible nostalgia for the old space age stadiums like Veterans Stadium and Riverfront. And all across America, they will be building replicas of Veterans Stadium.
Sterility is in.
I think it's a good point this instant gratification, the internet age, obviously that's not what baseball is. So it's, I sort of see that in the millennials that I don't know if the passion that we all have here, and that's why I think it's our job to, pass the baton and teach them what makes it so great.
It's our job to stay above ground, too.
I don't give the specifics of what you're talking about a moment's thought. What I do know is that the game itself has always overcome its surround. The surround is what hurts baseball. The ownership, players' unions, steroids. That's the surround. The game that they play always overcomes that surround because it is such a wonderful game. And I'm sure 100 years from now they'll be playing it and enjoying it as such.
I think we can squeeze in one last question, but we are pushing up against our deadline.
Eric, you mentioned the idea that you don't want anybody to tell you if you saw Honus Wagner or not. And I have to agree with you on that, in that I look at things, what perception and what is real and what's not. And in fact, in many, many things that we do in life, we don't even know what's real and what's not real. And what the whole board here, what do you think of the idea that now you say something, you say, oh, well, like in 1980, I thought Nolan Ryan missed the Bob Boone play in game five, and I saw it much later. It was a different thing. What do you think of the whole idea now that we can go back and we can now go back and say to you, Eric, well, you know, Eric, you're wrong or you're right or whatever. But it's what's playing in our minds, and I think we want to keep what's playing in our minds, but now we have this disconnect now. And what does the board think?
The past
about
becomes
that?
So literal because there are pictures of it.
Right.
A picture is worth 1,000 words, so how can you have any alternative idea of what goes on except the picture? The picture freezes things and makes them permanent.
It's amazing. I'm sorry. Go.
The only answer to that is that imagination frees itself up and can look at that same picture and perhaps, like a conspiracy theorist, say that the absence, it really means the presence, so the presence really means the absence. You play with it. It's a challenge, but you play with it.
It's amazing you bring up that play, because I would drive to the ballpark with Bill Verdon every day in Pittsburgh camp, and Bill Verdon says he still has nightmares of that ball hit by Boone that should have been a double play. He believes that.
Thank you.